Welcome to the Pastured Pig Podcast,
where we share the successes and challenges of raising pigs on pasture.
We talk to producers all over the country,
from small homesteads to large commercial pasture operations.
Whether you're new to pastured pigs or have been raising hogs for decades,
we hope you hear new ideas and new perspectives on pasturing hogs.
Here's your host, Troy McClung.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Pastured Pig Podcast. We're trying to get another episode out, so let's keep on trucking. So today we are going to Revercombe Farms in Virginia to talk with Mindy. And I've been talking with Mindy for a while. We bump into one another at the Homesteaders of America conference and try to get her on the podcast. She was a little shy at first, but we got her on, and I think it was well worth it. She was, I don't know, these introverted people, I don't understand how somebody could be introverted, because, you know me, I can talk forever. But I'm glad to got Mindy on. I thought she had a lot of good insight. And what's really neat is Mindy, they and their family have really turned their farm into an educational opportunity. So not only do they raise product, but they have an educational opportunity with what they do on pasture and some other things. So let's get in and hear what Mindy has to say on that, and I'll catch you guys on the back end of the interview. Today, we are just going back to East Virginia instead of West Virginia. We're going to East Virginia, and we're going to talk with Mindy Lipinski of Revercombe Farms. Welcome, Mindy.
Hello. Thanks.
All right. So how are things over in the motherland?
Oh, good. We're at the peak of mud season right now. So yes. I am looking forward to getting through that and for warmer weather and green grass.
Yeah, we just sent a heavy rainstorm your way, because it passed through here pretty quickly. So you guys should be getting it soon.
Yep, I see it coming over the mountain.
Yeah, that'll add to the mud for sure. It did here. All right. So Mindy and I, this is actually not Mindy and I's first meeting. We have met before, have we not?
We have a past. We have a history.
Yeah, we've run into one another several times, actually, at the Homesteaders of America conference. And I have to tell the story. I don't want to embarrass you, but I have to tell the story,
because
it does make me chuckle from time to time when I think about it. So our first ever endeavor of Kelly and I going to the Homesteaders of America conference in Central Virginia, we're there and meeting some people and you're meeting people that we watch on YouTube and that people we want to speak to and things, and vice versa. There's some people that are meeting us, and we just happen to notice every once in a while there's this lady that's just kind of standing off to one side. And it's like, oh, okay. You know, it's a big crowd, that type of thing. And what was funny is my wife is way more astute than I am. She finally said, I think that lady wants to talk to you. So I finally turned around, and sure enough, there was Mindy. And God bless Mindy. She I guess you tried several times to get in there, but you either I was just too boisterous or not paying attention or something. But anyway, so Mindy and I finally started talking and realized all the things we had in common. Over the next two HOAs, I think we ran into one another.
Yeah.
And just talked and caught up, and now finally get her on the podcast. She's been a little reluctant to be on the podcast because just kind of not her thing, right? Mindy would be the best way to describe it. Not something you really want to.
I'm an introvert by nature, and that's why I was kind of standing off, not talking to you, because I knew who you were immediately, and I wanted to, but I was working my nerve up.
Right.
And
right.
So. That conference, it was the one where all of the YouTubers were there, and there were some very pretty popular people there, and I'm not a big media person, and so I didn't know who most of them were, but I saw you and I knew who you were immediately, because I stumbled on your channel like pretty early on in this, and because proximity to me, you're not that far away. You're just, you know, I live right on the mountain, the West Virginia line.
Yeah.
So anyway, you were a big deal to me, so we'll just say that. And I'm very introverted.
All right, well, naturally. Thank you. I try to tell my wife I'm a big deal, but she doesn't fall for it.
Well, so. I'll tell her you're a pretty big deal.
All right. But what's interesting is and we'll get into this in a second. So looking at what Mindy has done on her farm since we first started talking, and kind of the the evolution of what you've been able to do there in the past 5-6 years is pretty cool. And we're going to get into that. And I would say that you have surpassed me in some experience and what you've been able to do on the farm. And I love it. I just love to see the growth that you guys have been able to have. So let's get into that. Let's back the truck up a little bit so everybody knows exactly what we're talking about here, because I've obviously made some jokes about Virginia, West Virginia. But as you mentioned, you are in the state of Virginia, but you're right against the border. So you're in a mountainous, hilly, sloped region just like we are. You're kind of dealing with the same issues that we are, correct?
Similar. So I live in the Shenandoah Valley. Obviously not the most famous Shenandoah Valley resident in farming for sure. But we've got the mountains and the valley and the hills and most of the same climates and weather, I guess, that y'all have over there.
Yeah, you've got a much wider valley than we do. We have we have crevasses is what I like to call it.
Yeah.
You guys. Yeah. The Shenandoah Valley is a pretty unique geological formation there. So it's nice to be in that area. So tell me a little bit about your farm. What is Rivercombe Farm made up of?
So actually my husband and I have 4 children and we, about 7 years ago had the opportunity to buy my great grandparents' home place. So our farm is 25 acres and it used to be part of a much larger farm, of which most of my family still lives on. So my dad, now that my grandparents have passed away, owns about 100 acres adjoining us. I have cousins flanking me on either side. I've got my aunts and uncles and my dad, you know, who live adjoining the land too. So it's pretty awesome where we live, and I love it.
Yeah, that's great, man. Talk about having some family history around. Incredible. Mm-hmm. So are they farming the land around you as well?
No, they are not. So the 25 acres that we bought, like I said, has the home place on it, not the original house, but, an old farmhouse that my great aunt and pictures. The rest of the farm is leased to crop farmers.
Okay.
And so we are the only ones actively farming the farm right now.
Okay. So you broke up there for a second, so I'll just fill in what I think was what you said there. So what's the land around you that is farm is being leased for row cropping, but you are really the only ones doing anything in the protein realm, sustainable realm, that type of stuff. Yeah,
absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. Alrighty. So, you said you have 4 boys, correct?
I do, and a granddaughter.
Wow. Okay. Excellent. Well, you're way too young to have a granddaughter.
I know. That's what I think too. But I was a young mom, and my son was a young dad.
All right. Well, cool. So, are how many boys are still at the house?
So right now just 2. So our 2 oldest sons, are in their 20s. They've, you know, moved on. One is married, like I said, with a daughter.
Yeah.
And here at the farm, I have a 16-year-old son and a 10-year-old son.
Okay. So you got some farm hands then. That works then.
Former farm hands. My 16-year-old was definitely my farm kid. But since he has gotten his license, he's discovered trucks and girls. So I don't see him much. He has an off-farm job. And my 10-year-old thinks that, you know, he just wants to live a normal life. He sometimes doesn't appreciate farm life or farm chores. So
yeah, that's the thing. I mean, that's the old adage. We grow up on a farm. We spend all of our youth trying to get off of it. And then, as we get older, we spend all of our time and effort trying to get back to it. So,
yeah, funny that's exactly
works.
Right.
Yeah. That'll come around. Well, that's okay. So you had a stint there for a while where you had some good help.
Mm-hmm. I did.
Yeah.
I did.
Yeah. You do what you can. You know, slave labor can only last so long. Okay, so on this 25 acres of the the old family farm, what do you, obviously we're going to talk about pigs here in a second, but give me the overview of what you're doing when it comes to farming, every aspect of it.
My main enterprises here are I do pastured poultry and pastured pork and homesteading type workshops. So I do a poultry and egg. It runs like a CSA. So it's just a 6-month subscription of poultry and eggs. So last year I raised about 600 birds here, processed on the farm, sold direct to consumer. And then with my pigs, I do the piglet sales and the workshops and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and that's one thing I find interesting, and we'll probably get down into this deeper, but your pastured pig business aspect, the cash flow is coming more from piglets than it is from actual pork sales. Is that correct?
That is correct. I have discovered that I like the farrowing part in the piglets much more than the growing of fat hogs.
Yeah. Yeah. Now you do still provide that service though, to some degree, correct?
Yes, I do for, two ways. One, if people request that I grow them out hogs to processing weight, I have and will do that. And two, I grow out a certain amount every year because we do host processing workshops on our farm to teach people how to do this home processing themselves.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. So I love the fact that you're diversifying your income through multiple streams, and of course the cash flow you see from the poultry, because that's a quick turn. Mm-hmm. And then of course the piglets make that a quicker turn. And then of course you still have some finishing, your on-farm education aspect obviously has some good cash flow there, I'm sure as well. So it's really neat to see that diversification of income across multiple platforms in case you just happen to have a bad year somewhere.
Yes.
So let's talk.
Yeah. And then,
oh, go ahead.
Sorry. I was going to say, I discovered last year that was really, really beneficial to me. Because I went through a situation last year where I had gotten a new boar hog and who just wasn't performing. So the piglets that I had anticipated having never came. And luckily I was able to follow on to those other enterprises to kind of get me through the year, and it was helpful.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's great. That's great. So are you primarily the farm hand? Does your husband help out, or is he off farm job type of situation? How does that balance for you?
So I am, all of this is my doing and my creation and my vision. Before we moved actually onto the farm, in our former life, we were, you know, quote unquote, normal. We weren't quite part of a subdivision, but, you know, for all intents and purposes, we were living in a subdivision, you know, fenced in yard and ground pool, the whole thing. And the discussion came up about our possibility of buying this farm. And I remember my husband specifically saying, I do not want to be a farmer. He does have an off-farm job. Actually, he owns his own plumbing company. But I do come home sometimes to find him doing very farmer looking things. So I think he enjoys it more than he lets on.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Closet farmer. You got to watch those types. Well, that's good. And it's good to have a plumber on a farm for sure, because there's
indeed
always water flow issues one way or the other.
To have any mechanically inclined person at all, which he definitely is. Is a benefit, especially, yes, one with a trade skill.
Yeah. All right. So it sounds like he's worth keeping around then.
Yeah, I think I'll keep him.
Okay. Wonderful. Wonderful. So tell me about, I gotta hit this, and I'm bouncing all over the place. So when you discover the idea of the farm property comes up to say, hey, you know, somebody in the family is thinking about selling this tract of land. Would you guys mm-hmm. be interested? Where does that go from, hey, we're here, we're in our home, we're kind of nestled in our picket fence little yard type of thing, to, yeah, mm-hmm. let's take on a big task like 25 acres. And, oh, by the way, let's make it a full working farm. How did that evolve?
So I've always, obviously, you know, I grew up on this farm, even though for most of my childhood, it was leased out to the crop farmers. You know, we grew a couple of steers out for the family every year. And so, you know, as a family, we always had that going for us. But yeah, none of this was even a plan when we bought the farm. So the farm came up for sale. You know, obviously we jumped on the opportunity. My dad had purchased the farm, you know, through as part of his inheritance. And so that's who offered it to us. And for whatever reason, he had three sows on the property, not many integral fences, but he had these three sows. And I guess he had a friend who had a boar that would, you know, come over to visit. And I don't know, it's just how my dad was. He just kind of dabbles in things. So I guess that was one of his pet projects, was these three sows. So we get here and we inherit the three pigs. And then we're just like, well, what are we going to do except for buy a boar? Let's start breeding pigs. Do I have any background in pigs? Like, nope, none at all. When I came here, I did have a little pot-bellied pig that he was housebroken. He lived in the house, but that was the only pig experience that I had. And for whatever reason, I just decided that, you know, I was just going to give it a shot. And so it was definitely a baptism by fire. We did so many things the hard way and had to learn so many lessons, the hard way, just because we just didn't know. And that's, mm-hmm. I think, why I stumbled upon you pretty early on. 'Cause I was like, look, I got to figure this out. And I've just really genuinely enjoyed them. They've been by far the funnest and most humbling at the same time, animal that we've taken on here.
Yeah.
And I've just expanded ever since.
Awesome. Yeah. I love that analysis of that. Yes. They're fun and they're very humbling. There's nothing like it. Like, So as
they keep you grounded.
Oh yeah. Literally. Well, that's funny. Yeah. That's good. Ties right in well with the story. I was just going to say the mud season. So I was just up in one spot where I've got a boar and two breeding sows and going up there to feed them yesterday. And of course the mud's really deep and trying to get through that. And this boar is so affectionate that he just wants mm-hmm. to keep his face against my legs. And he just, you know, rubs them and all that. And of course, he's got incredible hooks. You know, there's tusks in his, it just makes me nervous. But so I'm trying to keep him from rubbing up against me. And of course, they're all covered in mud. They're just such an affectionate animal. They're just rubbing up against me. And you know, of course, waiting for me to put the food down. And so I come out of there muddier than they are just because of affection, not because they're trying to tumble me or anything. They are just incredible animals. And to have something that heavy and that affectionate and that tasty all rolled into one, it's just like a perfect creation. So, all right. So let's talk about the breed type. So have you settled on a specific breed? Do you do all a cart? What are you dealing with there when it comes to breed?
I have a mixed bags of breed right now. Currently I only have one boar. He is a Berkshire. This is the first time that I've not had a Hampshire boar. But he's a pretty good guy, so I think I'll keep him around. He's doing his job very well, and he too is very affectionate. He's kind of intimidating because he's a talker. And so, you know, when 700 pounds of muscle and tusks come up to you and he's just, you know, making a racket, a lot of people's first inclination is to, you know, back away, but he's just talking and he loves his ears scratched.
Yeah.
And my sows, I've just got a menagerie of different breeds, all large type hogs, you know, none of the small breeds, but I've got some Duroc, Hamp crosses, some mixed breed blue butts. I think that's about it right now.
Yeah. So obviously, the one boar is servicing those sows. So you get a pretty eclectic variety of litters, I assume, then.
Yes. Oh, yeah. We definitely get the rainbow babies, for sure.
That's excellent. That's excellent. So, so are you doing one farrowing a year, two? What are you trying to manage there?
Right now, I've got eight sows that are breeders, and I am trying to consistently get two litters a year. The two of my sows actually came from our county fair. And so I will pull them out of the breeding herd and around September, and I will artificially inseminate, specifically with a show type pig, usually a Shipley's boar. Mm-hmm. So for those girls, their spring litter are more of the show lines. And I just kind of do that for fun and just for, you know, the local 4-H'ers. And then after, you know, after those piglets are weaned, then I put them back in with the boar. And so they will breed with the resident boar for their fall litter.
Excellent. Very cool. Yeah, that's good. That sounds like a good system. So, well, let's do this, because there's something I wanted to talk to you about as well in your pre-screening information. You talk about pulling out, pulling the certain sows out for show breeding and those type of things. So the thing that always sticks in my head when I hear people talk about that is I automatically think, okay, what type of infrastructure do they have in place to make sure you got sow A over here, boar B mm-hmm. over there, and you they're not running the show, you're running the show. So what have you all put in since you bought this farm 7 years ago? It didn't have any of this infrastructure for managing pigs. So what have you been able to set up in those past couple of years, and what have you learned works best for you all to manage that?
Woven wire, barbed wire, electric fence, and a sense of humor basically works best. All right. So our basic system here, which is still very much a work in progress, is I've got large paddocks set up. So I have a paddock that's kind of in the front. It's actually right next to the house up near the road. We live on a gravel road, but it is up next to the road, with shelters in it that is serving right now either as a grow out pen if I'm growing pigs for processing here, or when I pull the show pigs away from the boar to give them a lot of physical separation, I will put them up in this front paddock. And then in the back field, I've got an old chicken coop that we have turned into a farrowing shed. So I've got three stalls for the girls to go into to have babies. And so mamas with babies have their own barn and their own paddock field. And then on the other side of that barn is like a weaning paddock for the pigs that has hard paneled on the outside, and it's got an electric perimeter to just kind of introduce them to electricity. And then I have connected to that field is just a small segregation paddock if I need it, with a mobile shelter in it. And then connected to that is the large kind of general population area. So basically I'm just moving pigs. I have the ability to isolate them if I need to. I definitely pull mamas with babies away from the herd just so they can, you know, concentrate on their babies, not be bothered by the boar hog, and then they can get their extra rations without being harassed by the other members of the breeding clan that don't need that extra nourishment. But what is in the works is I'm going to take the largest field, like the general population field is what I call it, and kind of turn that into a kind of like a the wagon wheel rotation, where you have the sacrifice area and then you have the you know, spokes mm-hmm. paddocks kind of coming off from that.
Yeah.
So that way I can move my pigs more often in kind of a organized manner, maybe possibly start some reseeding after them to just kind of build up the grazing and forage in my pastures.
Yeah. Excellent. So you said something there that I think is important to point out, and that is, you know, 7 years in, you're still altering the system, you're mm-hmm. making changes, you're correcting things, because obviously I assume you're discovering things that work and don't work. You want to speak into that a little bit?
Oh yeah. So when we first started doing this, my very first objective was learning how to grow pigs. One, because I had never grown hogs before, large hogs. And then two, like learning how to do them on pasture. Because you just don't see too many pigs out in a field. So I had no idea really what I was doing or if I was doing it would really work. I almost felt like a liar at first when, you know, I first had my pigs and I called them like pastured pigs because they weren't really pastured. Like I had them on in a small area that, you know, pigs doing what pigs do, they had totally moonscaped it. So they were like dirt hogs. They weren't pastured pigs. So I just remember kind of feeling a little guilty of like calling them pastured pigs. So that at that point, I really didn't feel like that's what I had. But since then, we have learned a lot. We have changed a lot. We have an aerial photo of the farm that was taken the year before we bought it. And then to look at that picture and then to look like at what we have now, it miles a difference. Like you can't even tell. Yeah. Barely it's the same farm.
Yeah. And that's really neat to see, you know, just what we feel sometimes we got to keep from getting defeated when we put in a system and realize, okay, that just didn't work. Either it was a miserable failure or you come back and say, well, there's got to be more efficient ways to do this. There's a better way to make this happen. And I think that's what's so important. And of course, that's the beauty of embracing the regenerative agriculture model. If you had spent, you know, $10,000, $20,000, $50,000 in infrastructure and decide, well, I don't like that, I'm going to change it, then that could be, that could cripple you financially for a very long time. But being able to just move fencing around, some mobile structures that just get hitched up behind a vehicle and drug from point A to point B, then that gives you that freedom and flexibility to make those changes as you see fit.
Yeah. I mean, it takes me a year or more to decide if I want a permanent fence row somewhere. And that's the good thing about the pigs, especially the breeders, is, you know, they're so easily contained with just the electric fence. So I can, you know, set them up a paddock and try it out and really just decide like, okay, like this is for sure, you know, where I want this fence. So I like the flexibility that I have with them being able to just easily contain them.
Yeah.
With such a simple, effective method.
Yeah. So I have to ask you, since we're both in pretty much the exact same climate, have the very similar soil types and things, how have you managed your sacrificial area this time of year with the amount of pigs that you have on ground? Are you just keeping them in a tight spot and you're just like, okay, I'm going to go knee deep in mud for the next 2 months and just, it just is what it is? Or how have you been able to manage that?
So we have a pretty good relationship with the town. We're not even technically in that town. We're listed as Bridgewater, but the town of Dayton, which is right next door, they, for whatever reason, I don't know, I think my husband has something to do with it. They will deliver their leaves that they collect from the town and they will just deliver them to our farm. And so I will have a leaf pile as big as a building, you know, late fall, early winter. And we just take, we have a skid steer. And so the areas that the pigs concentrate on the most, we just give them plenty of leaf litter to just kind of, you know, protect the ground and give them something to kind of play around in and root in. And it helps a lot with keeping them from totally destroying the ground.
Yeah, that is fantastic. What a great resource. And my goodness, that has to be fun to watch too. You know, dumping leaves with the pigs and that.
Oh yeah, it's a blast. They is best time ever for them.
Wonderful. Okay, well, so let's talk about the piglet market a little bit here, and then I want to get on to some of your other workshop type stuff and the diversification there. But so with your piglets, discovering that you like doing the farrowing, you've obviously had good success with that. How did you start putting out feelers and finding your customer base when it came to selling those piglets?
So I started just putting them on Craigslist. Of course, when you have to do that, you get all kinds. I realized early on that that wasn't the best way I wanted to market my pigs, because I'm very particular. I'm very particular with my animals. The whole reason, one of the reasons why we started this, is because I just made a decision a long time ago that if I was going to eat meat, which I very much do, then I was going to feel good about how it was raised, how it was treated, you know, how it was slaughtered. And then balancing that with knowing that I'm raising animals, not as pets, but for, you know, people to harvest. When I started my Craigslist venture and just putting it out there, I had people showing up. I had one guy, you know, who wanted to buy all my piglets, but he wanted to, he didn't bring a way to haul them. And so he just asked if he could beat them in the head with a baseball bat to kill them, to just, you know, throw them in the car. And I said, no, we're not doing that.
Oh my goodness. Yeah,
it was a little crazy. So anyway, I started in that way. But since then, I've just connected with people. And then, you know, around here, your name kind of gets out there. And by word of mouth, people were reaching out to me. Sometimes I don't know where they have seen or heard, or, you know, so-and-so has told them about me. And I'm not even sure who so-and-so is at this point. So since then, I have gotten away. Occasionally I have to, you know, put out there and on Craigslist or whatever that I have pigs available, but usually I just keep a contact list of people that, you know, I know that they're looking for fall piglets. I know they're looking for spring piglets or whatever. And then when they pick up that year, I will just put their name down, to contact, the next year. So luckily I don't have to do a lot of advertising, because I have a controlled amount of piglets. So I don't have too many that I can't move.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've never not sold a pig. So even if I don't sell it as, you know, an 8 or 10 week old weanling, I can grow it out here and it's not going to go to waste. You know, we'll utilize it in a workshop, or I'll just sell it as a fat.
Yeah, it's not like you're just turning them loose. I didn't sell it, so I'm just going to turn it loose in the woods.
Yeah, and I don't purposely. I made a cognitive decision to not just take them to the auction houses. So,
yeah, that's great. Well, good. So I coming back around on that. So with your sows, how many litters are you getting out of your sows before you rotate them out?
So I don't really keep, there's no set number. Mm-hmm. But if the sow, so I just had to cull two of my sows out, over the winter time. They had missed two breedings. So I figured, you know, they were done. They were harvested here on the farm. The one, she actually missed two breedings. And then I pulled her away into, you know, another field, away from the boar, just to wait to make sure that she hadn't taken. And sure enough, as soon as I pulled her away, she started to bag up. So I let her have her babies, and then she proceeded to just lay on all of them. We didn't have any of them survive, so she didn't help herself in that manner. So when I feel like they're just getting too old, you know, they're missing breedings, one is okay. Two, I kind of take notice. And then if we get to number three, then you're done.
Yeah.
I try to either process them here on our farm for our family, or I do have somebody that I'm pretty good friends with that I can trust won't just, you know, take my sow and take her to the auction or whatever. He will process on his farm. So
yeah, very good.
That's my preferred method of.
So if you're graduating gilts into new breeders, what's some of the characteristics or what's some of the things you're looking for in that gilt to hold it back as a breeder?
Well, first off, I guess I kind of, if a piglet catches my eye and that she's just, I don't know, just an attractive looking pig, mm-hmm. which sounds kind of silly, but it's true. I will hold her back. You definitely have got to have a good temperament to stay on the farm. I just don't tolerate any aggressive behavior. Now, a new mom, you know, a newly farrowed sow who is being a good mom gets a little bit of grace with me. But if you're unnecessarily aggressive or standoffish, then you don't make the cut. Obviously, you've got to be receptive to the boar, because I've chosen some replacement gilts and they just weren't into their job. So, yep. You know, they didn't stay. And I don't really have a large, like a very quick turnaround. I try to get as much productivity out of my sows as possible. So I don't, you know, I haven't had to do this too often. And actually I prefer to get sows or replacement gilts from other pig farmers that I know, just so I'm not inadvertently what is it called, like line breeding. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to keep my genetics a little diversified. So
yeah, that's great. That's great. Well, and that brings me to another question, and this, there's a motive to my question because it's something I'm struggling with here on the farm and wanted to see how you're dealing with this. So with the amount of breeding that you're doing and obviously bringing some genetics in off farm, even bringing in some Shipley AI, do you have a vaccination regimen? Are you dealing with any of the farrowing diseases that are out there? Have you run into that yet?
So I have. One time, and this has been several years ago, and actually the sow is no longer here. I did have to put her down because she eventually suffered from a prolapse. Mm. But one time I had a sow that I had bought as a breeding sow from another farm. I brought her in, bred her. She had her piglets full term, but they were all born DOA. And after talking to some people, after talking to the vet, I came to strongly suspect that it was a lepto.
Yeah.
So since then, I have started the FarroSure
Gold
yeah. mm-hmm. Vaccine protocol. Am I perfect at it? No. But if I bring in a new pig, I definitely try to make sure that everybody gets their booster. But essentially I raise a pretty closed herd.
Yeah.
The only thing that I'm pretty diligent on, and it's not so much the pigs that stay here, but it's the piglets. When I round everybody up at about 2 weeks to castrate, I'll round up everybody and give an ivermectin injection. And then when they leave, anybody that leaves will get another dose of ivermectin just to start them off on a clean slate somewhere else.
Yeah.
And then otherwise, besides that, like I don't really do anything unless I suspect that there's an issue or a problem.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, the FarroSure Gold, I've had to do that because we had both of our breeding sows lose last year, and then one of the same ones lost this year. Total, thing went full term, all DOA,
and it's
one of those things. I've been pretty good with the Fair Share regimen, but I believe, I've got one too many boars, and that's shame on me. And the one that's more aggressive when it comes to breeding, I think he's my problem. So I've got him isolated, and he's on a short train to freezer camp, if you know what I mean. So it's just wondering, trying to flesh that out in my mind what I'm running into, and it's good just to get other people's input on that. But I have a feeling it's coming back to him, because he's my common denominator now. All right. So I want to be sensitive to your time, but I do want to talk real quickly about, and I think it's so important for everyone listening to hear these type of things. That way, I try to underscore this when we talk about pastured pigs, but we talk about the business of farming, the other value-added services that can come along with this, because we don't live in a vacuum. Most of us don't. When we're doing regenerative agriculture, when we're doing pastured pigs, we find our love isn't just for pigs. There's other things that we're using our land for, using our experiences for. So just briefly speak, I know you have your on-farm workshops for processing, but you also have some other opportunities for people to come on farm, learn some skills, and then, of course, that's a billable opportunity for you. Would you mind speaking briefly into that?
Sure, no problem.
So I have partnered with other... They're being a pain. I partnered with some other farmers, and we do basic homesteading workshops. We do, so when the growing season starts, we'll do canning.
I'm losing you a little bit there, Mindy. You're coming and going on me there. Sorry.
I might have to start over.
Okay.
So I partner with some other farmers, and we just, anything that can connect people kind of back to just this connection back to food, I guess, would be our primary goal with this. So in the growing season, we do a lot of canning workshops where we are not only showing people, how to can, if they're unsure, if they want to try it themselves. But we also, I have my workshop space, and I just kind of open it up. So it's really going back to this very communal way that food prep used to be. Mm. So, it's peach season and the peaches are in, and, you've got to peel them, and you've got to pit them, and you're canning them. And it used to be where you were doing all of this work, but you weren't alone. You were with your parents or your grandparents or your aunts or whoever, and it was very communal. And so we're very much trying to bring that sense of camaraderie and community back, and just make it normal again. So even if you're a seasoned canner and you know what you're doing, I still offer the space where you can get peaches, you can order them through me, and I will, pick up a bulk order from the local orchard, or you can bring your own. But I'll just open up the space, and you use our space, and you use our peelers and our canners or whatever. And then, it's not just you doing it. There's 10 of us there, and we're just chatting, and we're talking, and we're working up the peaches. And, you don't have to have that mess and stuff in your kitchen, but you're also just kind of reconnecting with people that value the same things that you do.
Yeah.
Whereas you're not, just buying the peaches from the store. You're putting them off yourself.
Well, yeah, that's losing you there again for a second, but that's fantastic. So what type of infrastructure investment do you have? I mean, when you bring everybody over and you're doing those canning things, is that all in your residential kitchen? Do you have an outside structure that you're doing that in?
So what we have is it's funny because it didn't start out to be this way. What it started out to be was a building that
when I processed my, you know, 100 or 150 chickens a year and our one or two pigs a year, you know, we weren't in this old shed. We were actually in a building. My husband, being the mechanically inclined tradesman that he is, kind of had the foresight to make this building several steps ahead of what we actually needed at the time. So what it is, it's, I mean, I have a butcher house on my farm. I actually had the inspector who handles the custom processing for poultry, that guy from Virginia, he came out just for my poultry exemption. Not that he needed to come out. I think he was just kind of new in his role and just, you know, making his rounds and introducing himself. But anyway, he came out to the facility to just see where I was processing chickens at. And he had a background in USDA and custom exempt processing. And he said, if I wanted to certify it and do custom processing for red meats, I wouldn't have a hard time getting the building, you know, up to code. Because my husband had the foresight to build it that specific. I mean, we even have like handicap accessible bathrooms or whatever.
Nice.
So anyway, it's a butcher house slack, but I don't like to call it a butcher house. I like to call it my workshop because I don't really want to be known as a butcher. So anyway, it's just a great workspace. I've got, you know, the full kitchen in there. We've got the big, you know, work tables. We've got the stainless steel tables. We've just got everything that we need to do all things canning and then homesteading. So we'll do, you know, workshops. You know, we've had like vanilla extract. I had one how to, you know, make and bacon the other week where we were making homemade bacon. We're doing jams and jellies coming up. I mean, we just kind of do all kinds of things here. Just whatever people are interested in learning, we'll, you know, bring some people together and we'll just do a little workshop on it.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Very cool. And that's what's neat is the value added of that to be able to help with cash flow, but then just get people introduced to the farm. So there's opportunity there as you build that customer base, that relationship. Then there's opportunities as you add new products and services. Then, of course, you've got an existing customer base that you can communicate that to.
Yeah, well, and I think people, it kind of just goes back to that, you know, connecting people back to their food. Because, you know, there's just no personal connection if you just go to Foodline or Walmart or whatever and you pick up your chicken there, but, you know, families like to come out here, you know, they pick up their chicken, you know, there's a good possibility that I will have piglets running around. They don't really stay contained in their field. So they could be just running by the door when they're here picking up other stuff. You know, the chickens and you know, we've just got, a lot of things here and it just kind of is a good reminder people that, you know, this ultimately is where your food should come from, if possible.
Yeah, no, that's good. Well, before I let you go, Mindy, I have to ask you the question I ask everybody. What is your favorite part about raising pigs on pasture?
I like it because I get I channel my inner Joel Salatin where I let he talks about the marvelous pigness of the pig.
Of the pig, yes.
I just like it that, yeah, I have these animals and I let them, you know, have a great, great life. And then just a very, very short, quick death.
Yeah.
And just to be able to just feel good about what we raise here and how we do it. And I just know that I'm just always doing the best possible, I'm always doing the best by my animals, and to just kind of feel good about, you know, being a meat eater, think is my favorite part.
That's great. Awesome. Well, if people want to find out more about you, obviously look at, maybe getting some piglets from you or some of the other services you offer, how can they find you online?
So I've got a website. It's just rivercombfarms.com, and it's R-E-V-E-R-C-O-M-B. Actually, it's a West Virginia name. There's a big Rivercomb clan in West Virginia that are not of my origin. Oh. And I am on Instagram. I am on Facebook. I'm just Rivercomb Farms.
All right. Wonderful. Well, I really appreciate you coming on the podcast. Glad that we finally got you on here after talking to you for so many years. But it was just a pleasure talking with you, and I pray you have a good day. Well, I really appreciate Mindy coming on the podcast. It was a pleasure talking with her. It's fun. I hope I run into her again at HOA so we can talk some more. She and her family are pretty cool to talk with. Speaking of homesteading conferences, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that Red Toolhouse Farm is actually co-hosting with the Capital Conservation District here in Central West Virginia. We're hosting a homesteading conference, and we will be talking about pigs quite a bit there, in September 13th and 14th. And that's in Charleston, West Virginia. We've got some pretty good speakers lined up. We've got Joel Salatin, Josh Draper from Stony Ridge Farm. We've got Sean and Beth Doherty from Eastern Ohio. And we have, who else do we have? Oh, we have Nathan Elliott from Out of the Woods. He's going to talk about sawmilling. And, of course, yours truly. And Chuck Lewis from Sheridan Park Farm. I'm anxious to see my good buddy Chuck again. He's going to come up. And we're going to be announcing some more participants and more speakers as we move along. But you can just go to the website called Homesteading Ish. So that's homesteading-ish. So it's Homesteading in Search of Help, if you're wondering what the ish means. Homesteadingish.com. And you can see ticket information there. But come on up to Charleston. We love to hang out with you guys and enjoy a couple days together. All right, well, I'm going to move on as I end this recording. I'm going to queue up our third interview that we have on deck, and that's with Rob Dowdle from Dowdle Family Farms. He and I, we spend a bit of time. This is going to be a little bit longer than normal, but he and I spend some time really diving into the woes of processing, things that we can't control, but then also how we can put things in place or some best practices to consider to help us manage the things we can't control when it comes to processing. So that'll come out next week. Hope you guys look forward to that. All right. Well, I pray everyone have a great week. Y'all take care.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of the Pastured Pig Podcast. To learn more about our podcast or to submit topics or recommend guests for future episodes,
visit redtoolhouse.com.